Hi, I'm Gavin Jackson, host of the South Carolina Lead, and this episode will sound a bit different from our previous. That's because this is a South Carolina Lead special report. The COVID-19 pandemic surge is happening in South Carolina. In fact, it has been for several weeks now, without relent. At Tylenz Community Hospital, Waccamaw, patients aren't overflowing into hallways on gurneys as you've seen in Hollywood depictions of deadly viruses. No, COVID-19 is much too infectious for that. If patients aren't diverted to another hospital with more capacity first, they're waiting in cars or the emergency waiting room area, sometimes for hours before being seen, and can wait even longer to be admitted upstairs to a bed or a critical care bed, depending on the severity of their symptoms. No, the surge is a steady, so far unrelenting flow of patients with mild to severe symptoms into hospitals like Tylenz Health Waccamaw and Murrells Inlet, where on this sweltering Thursday in July, 21 COVID-19 positive patients and 6 under investigation are in the hospital, and another 8, the sickest, occupy intensive care unit beds. They'd fill up even more beds if there was the staff to support them. It's a double-edged crisis of too many sick patients and a staff stretched thin. Hospital officials are scouring the country for nurses, with Tylenz Health expecting 28 right now to supplement their current levels. Some nurses trickle in each week as their duties end elsewhere. Even just the help of a few South Carolina National Guard medics, not nurses, deployed to the hospital have made critical differences in patient care. Gail Resitar, who is the chief operating officer of Tylenz Health, says the staffing shortage is the most critical part of the surge, a delayed surge that when it finally hit, it did so quickly.
Prior to about the middle of June, we were probably 25% behind normal volume because surgeries had been delayed, people had put off certain care, and we really didn't, we were really running a pretty low census of inpatients in our hospitals, both of our hospitals. So we were, because we were 25% behind normal, we were probably down some of our normal staffing, just what you would normally have. Somebody leaves and goes, retires or moves away. We weren't very quick to backfill them when we were running at about 25% behind. And of course, in South Carolina, everybody believed that April was going to be a bit of a surge, and it didn't happen. So we, you know, cleared the decks, so to speak, for a planned surge in April that didn't happen. And so we, in some ways, were sending staff home that we didn't need. So we let ourselves get a little behind our normal staffing. And then in a matter of about a week, we went from 3 COVID-positive inpatients to 45, almost 50, in just a few days.
Inpatient acute care is the most labor-intensive service hospitals provide. It's 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, with COVID-19 patients needing more attention. The total county rate of cases over the last 7 days is trending lower, but none of the hospitals in the area have seen decreases yet.
I think by the 22nd of June, we had 50 COVID-positive patients in our hospitals. And so because of that, that is a very fast time frame to go from 25% behind to 25% ahead. And the acuity level, the length of stay of those patients is longer than any other. It's about twice that of a normal hospitalized patient. And so it's creating the number of patients in the hospital every day is significantly above what we would normally experience this time of year.
What's happening within the walls of Tylenz Waccamaw on the border of Horry and Georgetown counties is not unique to the hospital. What is somewhat unique is the presence of a handful of National Guard medics in khaki-colored t-shirts, camo pants, and combat boots, an outfit more at home in theater than among the scrubs donned in the emergency department that Bruce Patillo directs.
Even though they're not functioning at the level of a nurse, they're certainly, you know, a welcomed asset to our department. So they're helping to decompress. And right now, I was pointing to triage. The backup right now is triage. Some days 5-6 hour waits. So if you've got extra set of hands that can start IVs and doing labs and EKGs, and we're even doing sepsis, starting your sepsis workups, do that out front. It does a couple of things. It facilitates the care. So if you feel like they're doing something for you, you're less likely to leave, right? Go to a doctor's office, and if they're moving you along, doing some testing, then you're more likely and more prone to stay. And that's what we're finding with my data. I check the data every day. So the left without treatments are decreasing as a direct result of having extra resources out front. And it's a, you know, first a patient safety concern, right, or issue. patient satisfier. And certainly, you know, it impacts our length of stays. Now, again, if we're in a holding pattern, your length of stays are still going to be, you know, somewhat off.
When a patient comes through those ER doors with respiratory distress, registered nurses like Amanda Lloyd evaluate what they need, whether it's oxygen, a BiPAP machine which helps push air into lungs, similar to the CPAP machine folks use with sleep apnea, or if they need to be intubated and put on a ventilator. From there, they go into a negative pressure room, which helps prevent airborne droplets from escaping into the emergency department. Then comes the personal protective equipment.
Obviously, our N95 or the PAPR, whichever you're fitted for. We do two sets of gloves, gowns, booties, hairnet, face shield. Definitely want to protect your eyes. So the full thing, the full PPE.
Amanda says plans for one nurse and PPE to handle all COVID-19 patients was the original plan, but things changed rapidly.
Initially, that was our plan, to have like what we called a dirty nurse, but then it just spiraled into everybody was considered a PUI or a person under investigation. So it just, that kind of went out the window because we had to, all of our nurses were taking care of, you know, respiratory type symptoms and, you know, just waiting on those results to come back. And even when they do, if the patient's symptomatic, you know, you can pretty much assume that even if that test is negative, that they could be positive, you know.
So that just adds to the stress of everything.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Adding all that equipment.
Yes, yes. And the hotness. You're sweating, you know, trying to do CPR in full PPE is not easy.
The surge that arrived in late June changed everything. Early on in March and April, a partially shut economy coupled with the fear of an unknown virus created a mission to flatten the curve that prevailed in preventing undersupplied hospitals from being overwhelmed in the beginning of the pandemic. Shortly after the projected peak, restrictions began to lift in May, and several healthcare workers said people started to let their guard down. Nearby beaches reopened. Hotels and short-term rentals started allowing guests back. Soon, they'd start flocking to popular bars and restaurants on Ocean Boulevard and elsewhere, which were to follow safety guidelines to prevent the spread. Instead, more than 4,000 cases occurred in Horry and Georgetown counties alone in July. And it's not just older patients with underlying health problems that Amanda is seeing.
Lots of young people. We just triaged, I think, a 30-year-old out front, and she's probably positive for COVID. And, you know, her sats aren't the best, and she's 30. You know, she's probably going to come back and need to be admitted to the hospital for probably COVID. Only 30 years old, you know, no underlying conditions. So it's scary.
The patients Dr. William Richmond is seeing in the emergency departments he oversees at Tideland's Waccamaw Community Hospital and farther down Highway 17 at Georgetown Memorial Hospital, which is nearly halfway to the Charleston area, are sicker. Daily, there are always patients waiting to be admitted, sometimes as many as 15. There are more patients than rooms that can be staffed. Such capacity constraints aren't new to hospitals, but are typically seen during mass casualty events. Not every single day for weeks on end. Here's what he faces when he walks into work.
Well, it's, you know, the COVID environment is just different. It's added another layer of complexity. Yours are always busy with this superimposed on everything else you have. Then when you go into work, you know there are going to be patients there that have been admitted that you can't move out of the emergency department because the hospital is full, over capacity, ICUs are full. So when that happens, all the patients that we see that have to be admitted until a bed opens up, stay in the ED. So you know when you come into work, there's going to be between 2 and 3 and as many as 14 or 15 patients that that are already in the department that, again, have been admitted that you're waiting to disposition upstairs. And they're typically sick. That's the reason they have to be admitted. Some are critical care patients. Some are on ventilators. So that takes up certainly time and effort. And then it also takes up space and it takes up nursing capacity and physician capacity. So then you still have, once again, superimposed on that a normal ED day with typical ER visits coming in, some of which are, you know, critically ill people. So it's just, you know, it's a relentless assault here by an unrelenting enemy. And just, you know, it doesn't seem to be any end in sight right now. So certainly in the thick of it. And it just, you can feel the weight of this burden hovering over, I think, the hospital, the department, and it, certainly we do the best we can. And, but it's difficult. It is, it's nothing like anything I've ever seen. And all the years I've been here, and I've been here 35 years practicing emergency medicine. And so certainly it's been eye-opening. I don't think I ever in my wildest dreams could have imagined we would endure something like this, but we are. And we'll eventually get through this, but we've got a ways to go. And very weightful and burdensome, but you know, you have a job to do and you have to take care of people, and they need help. And that's the only reason we're there, is to help people and care them. So we do it regardless of the circumstances. So I think that's probably the day. And then the day progresses along from that. You know, you're going to get new patients that need to be admitted. You're trying to, again, move some of those patients that were already admitted when your shift began. You're trying to get them upstairs. And some days you have more success doing that than others. So it's just really, it's quite an environment right now to practice medicine. And again, just no real rest for the weary at this point.
Upstairs in the critical care unit, it's a bit quieter. Instead of the white tile of the emergency department and overhead fluorescence, there's faux hardwood floors and subtle ambient light mixed with natural light coming in from windows. Nurses are buzzing around, and there's still the constant sound of beeps from machines and monitors. On this day, 8 patients on the floor are fighting COVID-19. After a nurse gives me a gown and gloves to wear around the unit, I was already wearing a mask, she tells me ICU nurse Michelle Baudet will speak with me in a moment. She's just hastily eating her lunch, something she and others typically squeeze in during their 12-hour shifts. When I meet Michelle, she describes the situation like this.
And right now we are beyond full, so there's never really a break right now. We get one patient better and then 2 more waiting for the bed, so nonstop. It hit mid-June and hasn't quit. I mean, we have not had a day that where the ICU is not full. It's full. It's been full since mid-June. And not just the ICU. I don't know the other floors, you know, but I know that they've been max capacity with the positive patients. And they're not all COVID, but we have our sick regular on top of all the COVID, so it's just...
And when she goes into a COVID-positive patient's room, she's donning up with the same PPE over her scrubs as Amanda in the ER described. But even getting a patient a cup of water, a previously routine task, is not the same. And there are added emotional burdens as well.
Same stuff, just a different, like I said, a whole different game because we do, there are certain things we have to wear gowns and gloves for, but it's not anything like this. And you have to, have to keep the doors closed. The patients, I feel like the ones that aren't ventilated, they just feel so isolated. Because they are. I mean, because you can't just, they warm a cup of water and you can't just say, okay, and here you go. And it's, you have to gown up. And so every time, it's just a difficult, you try to explain that to them and they do understand, but I know how hard, I could only imagine how hard it would be to just not be able to have your loved ones with you and not, just to be in there. Just look at our doors are, they're glass doors, so they're kind of just like, you're like in a glass box. everybody's looking at you, staring at you, but it's just hard. But before all that, that's the biggest thing is the patients and the loved ones. We have, because they're not able to visit, you're intercepting numerous phone calls for family members and loved ones. That's huge. I mean, we always get calls, but nobody is coming in and visiting, so everybody's maxed out patients, 17 patients, family members are calling at least two or three times a day to get updates. That's difficult just to intercept the phone calls in between going in and out of the rooms. Not having the loved ones here for the family members is a big help to us for them to have, be here for the patients a lot of times.
There are bad days. Patients are so sick, Michelle says, that it's hard to help them. The unknowns and trying new treatments are the constants. Yes, there are survival stories that give her hope, and hearing from those, she's helped.
We've had success. Several months back when we had the first round of this, was nothing like this, but we did have, some very sick COVID-positive patients, and we had a lady, I know she was probably, not to say she was in her 60s, but she... was probably one of our first successes from coming off the ventilator. She called a few weeks back to say thanks. And it was just, when she said her voice, she said her name and I heard her, she had an accent. So I could just, you know, it was just wonderful to hear her voice. And she got tearful and, you know, thanking everybody, just so, you know, so grateful that, that she's here. And we are too. But that's a good story. And then there are lots that are, you know, some of these folks are just too young and one life is one too many to lose. But, you know, we have 40-year-old people, you know, that are getting these horrible symptoms and having to be intubated and sometimes not making it. And their loved ones can't come see them. And they could be dying and they can't see them. I mean, there's been several, unfortunately, that stick out. But I mean, that's the hardest. Just young folks that, you know, I say young, they're way too young for this to be hit. You know, everybody, well, they're not. You know, it's just old people. It's, you know, no, it's not. And we see it. You know, I see 40s and 50-year-old folks that are succumbing to it. You know, and there's no rhyme or reason for why they got sicker than this person, you know, and that's so frustrating, you know, you don't know there are certain things that, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, and you do mostly see that in folks, but not all of them.
ARDS, which stands for Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome, and pneumonia from COVID, fills the lungs with fluid and prevents the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide. This starves the body of critical oxygen, leads to organs failing, and for some, death. Michelle has a hard time explaining just how different this situation is from daily ICU life that she's dealt with over 14 years as a nurse.
It's so hard to explain. It just sounds like, oh, okay, well, that's just a typical day, but it's not. There's no way you just have to go down that hall and there's nothing typical about it right now. This is completely different for all nursing and all healthcare involved.
After our chat, I follow Michelle down the hallway to see the world she operates in more than 48 hours a week. Outside of some doors, equipment and IVs on poles are connected to patients, some in medically induced comas, behind sliding glass doors, a workaround to limit interactions. She checks the equipment as other nurses farther down the hall wheel a mobile x-ray machine into a patient's room, which has led to a discovery that requires immediate attention. Michelle is gowning up in the hallway outside of her patient's room as other nurses are a flurry looking for sterile gowns ahead of an emergent procedure that's about to take place down the hall. Even the critical care doctor stops to ask Michelle and another nurse if there are any Tyvek coverall suits, which have a nickname.
We have bunny suits.
Bunny suits?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Call the OR.
Yeah.
Let me go look at Tonya's office.
Michelle explains what's happening.
So the gentleman down the hall is... A 41-year-old guy that's very recent. All right, there's yours. That's the one. Having to do an emergent procedure on the pressure because of the ARDS that we have. We don't tell you, it's so hard to get the oxygen through. The setting that they use, it has to be a real big, if it puts a lot of pressure on the lungs, and unfortunately sometimes it can cause pneumothorax, so it could collapse lungs. So now the doctor's got to go in, put a chest tube in to blow the lung back up because the pressure just so great on the vents, it's required to give them, to ventilate them. Unfortunately, that's a side effect.
Now, fully suited up, listen to just how challenging it is to hear her through her surgical mask, N95 mask, and a face shield.
And it's hot, and it's wet, and then we have to do IVs and see through all of it. And then the patients, if they come, we're coming at them, they think we're aliens or something, can barely sometimes, especially the elderly, they're hard of hearing, they really can't hear when we're covered up and communication can be difficult.
It's not a typical ICU anymore, as she said. Not like any Michelle Baudet remembers. She had previously worked with these acute care patients before transitioning to handling outpatient transfusions. But when the peak was expected in late April, the hospital put her into the critical care unit in preparation. It was one of the many strategies the hospital employed to be as ready as possible for a surge that came weeks later in mid-June and hasn't stopped.
I think there was, like there usually is with events such as this or mass casualties, there's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm, as there should be initially.
Again, Dr. William Richmond, who is Thailand's Health Director of Emergency Services, who we heard from before.
As it moves forward, you again can feel the weight of the situation, certainly when you're at work, and then, you know, you do take it home with you. So I think that is difficult. I think, in my personal opinion, I think it's been more difficult for the nurses. Our nurses have just done an exemplary job, and, you know, we're short staffed. We don't have the nursing help that we need, and so we'll have nurses that will work all day, and there'll be a shift or two to cover. And they'll say, okay, I'll do another shift, and they'll do two shifts, and then they'll go home, get a little bit of sleep, and come back and do it all over again. So they're certainly spending a lot more time at the hospital than they are home. So I think that it's been more weightful, in my opinion, on the nurses, and the way they've rallied to this has been just exceptional. There's no escape. There's just no escape. You know, you feel it when you're at work. You feel it when you go home. You think about it. And but you have no, you know, there's no option here other than put one foot in front of the other and keep going. I think the other physicians have had it difficult, certainly in the ER. My partners and I see so much of this, and we're on the front end and sort of the firing line. But our critical care physicians have also done yeoman's work. I mean, they're just two of them we have, and they're working literally every single day. I'm talking one of them, Tom Chandler, I think he's had one day off in the last 30 days. And so it's just crazy. And again, there's no way not to feel that, and no way it's not going to have, you know, personal effects, but you have to persevere.
Maybe one day off in 30 days. Just think about that. That is what the surge looks like. And even the surge Thailand's is facing is different from what other hospitals are seeing. Gail Resitar, the chief operating officer, says that unlike Regional Medical Center in Orangeburg, which is setting up a tent field hospital known as an alternate care site, that Thailand's got ahead of the need to do that by relying on other outpatient facilities in their networks, where patients are also receiving care for other ailments.
We were prepared for and have these external tents to the ED, which you typically manage your lower acuity in. We didn't really need that because our lower acuity in our service area right now is being handled in our primary care network. And that's working great. That keeps patients off of the ER and off of the campus. So there are other alternatives. We do have an approval for an alternate care site, but not an external to the ED tent. We have on the fourth floor of the facility across the street. Portion of that fourth floor is inpatient rehab. It's a partnership with Encompass. There are comprehensive rehabilitation beds that you might go to after a stroke or some kind of major functional injury or illness. Those beds could be potentially utilized for acute care. So we got approval to do that. The problem today is I can't staff all the beds that we have in the building today. So picking up another 29, although it would be helpful, the issue is the limiting factor is staffing, not physical space. And that's pretty much the case everywhere.
While inpatient elective surgeries, a big revenue driver for hospitals, have been curtailed, other services are taking place in outpatient facilities, which have helped with a revenue squeeze.
Our cost to provide it, whether it's an agency nurse at a premium, or the premiums of dollars that we're paying our staff, or reallocating staff, all those things cost a lot more than the normal care you would, normal salaries that you would typically see. Some services that have continued have helped, but it's still a really difficult time, for sure. We furloughed a lot of staff. We're in the process of getting some of those back now. We reduced pay for a lot of our leadership for a period of time, and, you know, we're hoping to begin to ramp that back now that we have so many of our ambulatory services back open and operational. But it's hard. Hospitals have pretty lean margins to start with. And so it doesn't take much to throw us under.
Those were just some of the stories on the front line of this pandemic that affects us all. And this is only a look at one hospital. every hospital is facing some variation of what Thailand's is going through. Each one of the people I spoke with said they wish people could see the pandemic through their eyes to see just how drastic the situation is. Think about Michelle, that nurse. She takes it home with her every day to her family. Dr. Richmond worries about his wife, who is also a physician, and avoids watching the news now, opting just for exercise to give him a reprieve from the unprecedented surge that awaits him each day he returns. As for moving forward, the future still remains unknown. While case numbers are trending downward in the state, the hospital remains over capacity. I leave you with this response from Dr. William Richmond when I asked him what he's concerned about the most.
I think that it would get worse. You know, right now we plateaued. We're in a steady state. We know how to deal with this. If we have more of a surge, and we just don't have that capacity to take a more significant surge than we already have. Again, hospital is just full, really over capacity. ICU is full. ER is holding patients. And when I was talking about the ERs holding 13, 14 patients, that's one ER. We have two ERs. So sometimes you have both ERs, you know, holding 10, 12 patients. So you're holding 25, 30 patients in a day, worst case scenario. And that's just difficult. So if that gets worse and you have more of these patients and they become sicker, they're just, you know, there's a finite amount of space. There's a finite amount of people. And there are so many other areas in the country going through what we are. And so when you try to have nurses come here and do other things, again, there are lots of places with the same needs. And so it's hard to find the additional help that we'd like to find. And I think this is a once in a generation or several generation occurrence. It's just really unbelievable.
For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina.